Chapter 17. Though nobody was there to see what S.E. had done, she quickly tore up the slip and threw it away. After this she grew cool and laughed at herself, walked about the room, and laughed again, not joyfully, but distressfully rather. It was quickly known in Casterbridge that Farfrae and Henchard had decided to dispense with each other. Elizabeth Jane's anxiety to know if Farfrae were going away from the town reached a pitch that disturbed her, for she could no longer conceal from herself the cause. At length the news reached her that he was not going to leave the place. A man following the same trade as Henchard, but on a very small scale, had sold his business to Farfrae, who was forthwith about to start as corn and hay merchant on his own account. Her heart fluttered when she heard of this step of Donald's, proving that he meant to remain, and yet, would a man who cared one little bit for her have endangered his suit by setting up a business in opposition to Mr. Henchard's? Surely not, and it must have been a passing impulse, only which had led him to address her so softly. To solve the problem, whether her appearance on the evening of the dance were such as to inspire a fleeting love at first sight, she dressed herself up exactly as S.E. had dressed then, the muslin, the spencer, the sandals, the parasol, and looked in the mirror. The picture glass back was, in her opinion, precisely of such a kind as to inspire that fleeting regard, and no more, just enough to make him silly, and not enough to keep him so, she said luminously. And Elizabeth thought, in a much lower key, that by this time he had discovered how plain and homely was the informing spirit of that pretty outside. Hence, when she felt her heart going out to him, she would say to herself with a mock pleasantry that carried an ache with it, "No, no, Elizabeth Jane, such dreams are not for you." She tried to prevent herself from seeing him and thinking of him, succeeding fairly well in the former attempt, in the latter not so completely. Henchard, who had been hurt at finding that Farfrae did not mean to put up with his temper any longer, was incensed beyond measure when he learned what the young man had done as an alternative. It was in the town hall, after a council meeting, that he first became aware of Farfrae's coup for establishing himself independently in the town, and his voice might have been heard as far as the town pump expressing his feelings to his fellow councilmen. These tones showed that, though under a long reign of self-control he had become mayor and churchwarden and whatnot, there was still the same unruly volcanic stuff beneath the rind of Michael Henchard as when he had sold his wife at Wagdon Fair. "Well, he's a friend of mine, and I'm a friend of his, or if we are not, what are we? Odds end, if I've not been his friend, who has, I should like to know? Didn't he come here without a sound shoe to his boot? Didn't I keep him here, help him to a living? Didn't I help him to money, or whatever he wanted? I stuck out for no terms, I said name your own price. I'd have shared my last crust with that young fellow at one time, I liked him so well. And now he's defied me. But damn him, I'll have a tussle with him now at fair buying and selling, mind at fair buying and selling. And if I can't overbid such a stripling as he, then I'm not worth a varden. We'll show that we know our business as well as one here and there." His friends of the corporation did not specially respond. Henchard was less popular now than he had been when nearly 2 years before they had voted him to the chief magistracy on account of his amazing energy. While they had collectively profited by this quality of the corn factors, they had been made to wince individually on more than one occasion. So he went out of the hall and down the street alone. Reaching home, he seemed to recollect something with a sour satisfaction. He called Elizabeth Jane. Seeing how he looked when she entered, she appeared alarmed. "Nothing to find fault with," he said, observing her concern. "Why, I want to caution you, my dear. That man, Farfrae, it is about him. I've seen him talking to you two or three times. He danced with E at the rejoicings, and came home with E. Now, no blame to you. But just hearken. Have you made him any foolish promise? Gone the least bit beyond sniff and snaff at all? No. I have promised him nothing. Good. All's well that ends well. I particularly wish you not to see him again. Very well, sir. You promise? She hesitated for a moment, and then said, Yes, if you much wish it. I do. He's an enemy to our house. When S.E. had gone, he sat down, and wrote in a heavy hand to Farfrae thus. Sir, I make request that henceforth you and my stepdaughter be as strangers to each other. She on her part has promised to welcome no more addresses from you, and I trust, therefore, you will not attempt to force them upon her. M. Henchard, one would almost have supposed Henchard to have had policy to see that no better modus vivendi could be arrived at with Farfrae than by encouraging him to become his son-in-law. But such a scheme for buying over a rival had nothing to recommend it to the mayor's headstrong faculties. With all domestic finesse of that kind, he was hopelessly at variance. Loving a man or hating him, his diplomacy was as wrong-headed as a buffalo's, and his wife had not ventured to suggest the course which she, for many reasons, would have welcomed gladly. Meanwhile, Donald Farfrae had opened the gates of commerce on his own account at a spot on Durnover Hill as far as possible from Henchard's stores, and with every intention of keeping clear of his former friend and employer's customers. There was, it seemed to the younger man, room for both of them and to spare. The town was small, but the corn and hay trade was proportionately large, and with his native sagacity he saw opportunity for a share of it. So determined was he to do nothing which should seem like trade antagonism to the mayor, that he refused his first customer, a large farmer of good repute, because Henchard and this man had dealt together within the preceding 3 months. He was once my friend, said Farfrae, and it's not for me to take business from him. I am sorry to disappoint you, but I cannot hurt the trade of a man who's been so kind to me. In spite of this praiseworthy course, the Scotchman's trade increased. Whether it were that his northern energy was an overmastering force among the easy-going Wessex worthies, or whether it was sheer luck, the fact remained that, whatever he touched, he prospered in. Like Jacob in Paddan Aram, he would no sooner humbly limit himself to the ringstrict, and spotted exceptions of trade than the ringstrict, and spotted would multiply and prevail. But most probably luck had little to do with it. Character is fate, said Novalis, and Farfrae's character was just the reverse of Henchard's, who might not inaptly be described as Faust has been described, as a vehement, gloomy being who had quitted the ways of vulgar men without light, to guide him on a better way. Farfrae duly received the request to discontinue attentions to Elizabeth Jane. His acts of that kind had been so slight that the request was almost superfluous. Yet he had felt a considerable interest in her, and after some cogitation he decided that it would be as well to enact no Romeo part just then for the young girl's sake no less than his own. Thus the incipient attachment was stifled down. A time came when, avoid collision with his former friend as he might, Farfrae was compelled, in sheer self-defense, to close with Henchard in mortal commercial combat. He could no longer parry the fierce attacks of the latter by simple avoidance. As soon as their war of prices began, everybody was interested, and some few guessed the end. It was, in some degree, northern insight matched against southern doggedness, the dirk against the cudgel, and Henchard's weapon was one which, if it did not deal ruin at the first or second stroke, left him afterwards well nigh at his antagonist's mercy. Almost every Saturday they encountered each other amid the crowd of farmers which thronged about the marketplace in the weekly course of their business. Donald was always ready, and even anxious, to say a few friendly words, but the mayor invariably gazed stormfully past him, like one who had endured and lost on his account, and could in no sense forgive the wrong, nor did Farfrae's snubbed manner of perplexity at all appease him. The large farmers, corn merchants, millers, auctioneers, and others had each an official stall in the corn market room, with their names painted thereon, and went to the familiar series of Enchard, Everden, comma, Shiner, comma, Darton, and so on, was added one inscribed Darfrey, in staring new letters. Enchard was stung into bitterness. Like Bellerophon, he wandered away from the crowd, cankered in soul. From that day Donald Farfrey's name was seldom mentioned in Enchard's house. If at breakfast or dinner Elizabeth Jane's mother inadvertently alluded to her favorite's movements, the girl would implore her by a look to be silent, and her husband would say, "What are you to, my enemy?" 18. There came a shock which had been foreseen for some time by Elizabeth, as the box passenger foresees the approaching jerk from some channel across the highway. Her mother was ill, too unwell to leave her room. Enchard, who treated her kindly, except in moments of irritation, sent at once for the richest, busiest doctor, whom he supposed to be the best. Bedtime came, and they burned the light all night. In a day or two she rallied. Elizabeth, who had been staying up, did not appear at breakfast on the second morning, and Enchard sat down alone. He was startled to see a letter for him from Jersey in a writing he knew too well, and had expected least to behold again. He took it up in his hands and looked at it, as at a picture, a vision, a vista of past enactments, and then he read it as an unimportant finale to conjecture. The writer said that she at length perceived how impossible it would be for any further communications to proceed between them now that his remarriage had taken place. That such reunion had been the only straightforward course open to him, she was bound to admit. On calm reflection, therefore, she went on, "I quite forgive you for landing me in such a dilemma, remembering that you concealed nothing before our ill-advised acquaintance, and that you really did set before me in your grim way the fact of there being a certain risk in intimacy with you, slight as it seemed to be after 15 or 16 years of silence on your wife's part. I thus look upon the whole as a misfortune of mine, and not a fault of yours. So that, Michael, I must ask you to overlook those letters with which I pestered you day after day in the heat of my feelings. They were written whilst I thought your conduct to me cruel, but now I know more particulars of the position you were in, I see how inconsiderate my reproaches were. Now you will, I am sure, perceive that the one condition which will make any future happiness possible for me is that the past connection between our lives be kept secret outside this isle. Speak of it, I know you will not, and I can trust you not to write of it. One safeguard more remains, to be mentioned that no writings of mine, or trifling articles belonging to me, should be left in your possession through neglect or forgetfulness. To this end may I request you to return to me any such you may have, particularly the letters written in the first abandonment of feeling. For the handsome sum you forwarded to me as a plaster to the wound I heartily thank you. I am now on my way to Bristol, to see my only relative. She is rich, and I hope, will do something for me. I shall return through Casterbridge and Budmouth, where I shall take the packet boat. Can you meet me with the letters and other trifles? I shall be in the coach which changes horses at the Antelope Hotel at 5:30 Wednesday evening. I shall be wearing a paisley shawl with a red center, and thus may easily be found. I should prefer this plan of receiving them to having them sent. I remain still, yours, ever, Lucetta." Enchard breathed heavily. "Poor thing, better you had not known me. Upon my heart and soul, if ever I should be left in a position to carry out that marriage with thee, I ought to do it, indeed." The contingency that he had in his mind was, of course, the death of Mrs. Enchard. As requested, he sealed up Lucetta's letters, and put the parcel aside till the day as he had appointed. This plan of returning them by hand, being apparently a little ruse of the young lady for exchanging a word or two with him on past times. He would have preferred not to see her, but deeming that there could be no great harm in acquiescing thus far, he went at dusk and stood opposite the coach office. The evening was chilly, and the coach was late. Enchard crossed over to it while the horses were being changed, but there was no Lucetta inside or out. concluding that something had happened to modify her arrangements, he gave the matter up and went home, not without a sense of relief. Meanwhile, Mrs. Henchard was weakening visibly. She could. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.